listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about some proposed changes that could come to your weather forecasts and why the National Weather Service wants your input. First, in 1909, the Wisconsin legislature designated almost 4,000 acres in Door County as Peninsula State Park. A few years later, two St. Louis women opened Camp Monaga for girls. Our next guest compiled the history of the park and the camp in her new book, a history that lasts from 1916 to 1948, encompassing two world wars and the Great Depression. Kathleen Harris is the author of From the Lookout, Memories of Peninsula State Park's Summer Camp for Girls. Kathleen, welcome to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Camp Monaga was created shortly after Peninsula State Park itself was formed. How were those beginnings connected?
Well, let me start with how camp got started. It really arose out of necessity. There were two women who found themselves in a financial pickle. They were from Missouri, and they were raising their children alone. In October of 1915, they went to something called the Veiled Prophet Parade in Missouri, in St. Louis, Missouri. And in talking to each other, they knew each other through their children who attended school together. They realized that they were both thinking of the same solution, to open a summer camp for girls. And so they did that. The idea took hold, it took off, and camp was successful for 33 years. And as you said, Rob, at the same time, Peninsula State Park got its start in 1909. It was actually the second state park in Wisconsin, the first being Interstate, established in 1900. But Peninsula was the park that came about when a system of state parks got going. And for me, the rise of a camp like Camp Monaga, the rise of summer camps, really, youth camps in America, and the rise of state parks had some things in common. A lot of things were happening at that time in America. I'll just mention a couple. One was the United States, this great nation of ours, was changing from an agrarian society to an industrial society. There was something called the Great Migration, where African Americans and others were moving to the cities for work. There were changes in medicine and technology. In medicine, for example, not long before camp got going, around the turn of the last century, 1 in 7 people died of tuberculosis. The idea of vaccines, that's a big discussion point today, was just becoming to be known. So much was changing. And of course, the other obvious thing related to this book were gender roles and also roles of different cultures and races. So a lot of those things happened at the same time. As far as the park goes, there was also something called the progressive movement. And part of that involved the concept, the idea that public land was there for the public, for people, for anybody who, you know, you didn't have to be able to afford it to enjoy public land. The rise of state parks like Peninsula was given for a few reasons, being things like preserving cultural and natural features. But I think a lot of your listeners might be surprised to know that health and spiritual renewal were also a justification presented by John Nolan, the landscape architect who really provided that, or created that first treatise to establish state parks to the legislature. So lots of things going on at the same time. But as far as Monaga goes, it was personal necessity of these two women who needed to make some money without a lot of options at the time that really gave rise to Monaga.
And can you talk about the kinds of campers, the girls and young women who ended up spending weeks at Camp Monaga?
Sure. So the girls who attended Camp Monaga were by and large wealthy girls, middle and upper class girls. So people like your listeners might recognize names like the Kimball girls. That would be Kimberly Clark. How about the Turnbull twins? They attended Camp Monaga in the 20s. Their dad was the first president of the Green Bay Packers. There was a woman named Alice Holtz who attended Camp Monaga. Her father was a diamond merchant from Chicago. Now, that's not to say there weren't other girls that weren't as wealthy that went to camp. There were. But by and large, these were middle and upper class girls. And the other audience that From the Lookout that tells their, the other story that is told to some degree are the workers who were at camp. So there were a lot of local kids, youth, and then also older, you know, adults who worked there. And parts of their story are told as well.
And this was a big, this was a big deal in the community when all of a sudden there was this camp bringing in people from around the state and in some cases around the country. What was the local reaction like?
I think A.E. Doolittle, who was the park's first manager, he was there for about 30 years. He was smart enough to know that having a summer camp for girls would be good for relations. You have to remember that when Peninsula was established, as much as we think everybody would love the idea, if you were one of the 30 or so families who had land and were forced to sell or were given a life lease, you were not very happy. And so there actually was a lot of, I guess, friction in the community. And A.E. Doolittle knew that this camp would provide jobs for people, for local people. And indeed it did. So
we're talking to Kathleen Harris. Her new book is From the Lookout, Memories of Peninsula State Park's Summer Camp for Girls. She worked at Peninsula State Park, by the way, as a naturalist for 25 years. Kathleen, can you tell us a little bit about what life was like for the girls who attended this camp? It's an interesting mix, you write, of, you know, kind of training in, I guess, stereotypically feminine things, but also stuff that usually only the boys got to do. Tell us about that mix.
Well, that changed over time. When Mrs. Clark and Mrs. Mabley established camp, they assured parents, for example, that the girls would only participate in one strenuous activity a day. And that was, they were really referring to athletics. And the fear was at the time that if you did too many strenuous activities, that you wouldn't be able to have children, basically. That changed as the understanding of athletics and women's sports changed. So they did that. The girls participated in horseback riding, not Western saddle. This was pre-Bonanza. These were saddlebred horses that were brought up from Milwaukee and Chicago at one point. They, of course, the waterfront was a big deal, so sailing lessons was happening too. And then they had the traditional camp activities that you would think about, campfires and hiking and those sorts of things. But Mrs. Clark and Mrs. Mabley also knew that they wanted these girls to be prepared for a changing world and to be able to present themselves in society and in the working world. That changed over time as women entered the working field. So they had things like literary, where girls would write essays and poems and then recite them for each other. They invited the girls to proper teas at the cottage. So there were those sorts of things as well.
And they went through some tough times in American history, you know, through two world wars and the Great Depression. How did the camp react to some of those big events while they were, you know, bringing girls in for the summer?
Well, one of the ways we know how the girls reacted and how the broader social trends were, the broader events were affecting Monaga was because of the pack and paddles. Those were the camp yearbooks. So during both wars, camp was active in raising funds for, in the First World War, Belgian war orphans, in the Second and the First, the Red Cross. So world events really did impact Monaga. The other thing that impacted it that From the Lookout tells about is, of course, the Great Depression and the financial challenges that Monaga faced.
And as we start to wrap up, what do you hope people take away from looking back at the story of the campers and staff of Camp Monaga today?
Well, I think you can read the book in two ways and maybe reread it in different ways. So on the surface, in today's times when there's so much news that's stressful, so many people have tough times themselves, I think Camp Monaga, the story of Camp Monaga told in The Lookout is a nostalgic look at a bygone era. And it's a fun read. There's poems and music and all kinds of things in there. But on a deeper level, for me, the story of Camp Monaga also tells how to live a life, perseverance, friendship, the things you need to get through those changing times. So those would be the things I hope people take from the book. And I might add, too, the idea of preservation of place. Because place without memory is just a point on a map. In order to preserve places like Peninsula State Park, we need to know what happened there and why it's important to preserve it.
Kathleen, thanks so much for sharing it with us today.
Thank you.
Kathleen Harris is an author and naturalist who shared her new book with us. It's called From the Lookout. It chronicles the history of Camp Monaga in Peninsula State Park. Coming up, the National Weather Service is seeking public input on proposed changes to its severe weather warning system. We'll talk to a weather coordinator coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement went into effect this week, replacing NAFTA. We'll talk with a trade expert about what it means for Wisconsin and what questions still need to be resolved. First, it's hot and muggy throughout a lot of the state as we head toward the July 4th holiday weekend. And with summer temperatures come the possibility for severe weather like thunderstorms, tornadoes, and flash floods. And when that kind of weather comes, you may see alerts through notifications on your phone, on your TV, or even right here on the Ideas Network. But in recent years, there's been some confusion over the distinction between the various levels of alerts, from advisories to watches to warnings. Now, the National Weather Service is seeking public input on ways the agency can make these alerts more clear so you can stay safe in the event that severe weather strikes in your area. Tim Halbach is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist for the National Weather Service office in Milwaukee Sullivan. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tim, why is the Weather Service wanting to take a closer look at how they let us know about impending weather?
Well, we've had the system in place for decades now, and it's something that we've taken feedback that maybe we're not hitting the mark on messaging and getting the information to people properly. There's historically been a lot of confusion just in terms of what a watch means, what a warning means, what an advisory means. So this step that is being looked at right now is mainly for the advisories and how people interpret that and whether or not they need that headline in order to understand what's coming their way. So there's a pretty big effort that's it's been about 5 years in the making. Wow. Where the National Weather Service has been having meetings with social scientists, doing surveys with small focus groups into, you know, you have a winter weather advisory that's in effect for your location. What do you understand this to mean for you? Do you think that a winter storm warning is worse than an advisory, a winter weather advisory? So it's really taken a look at our big system of all these products that we put out and trying to find which ones are necessary and which ones are causing confusion for people.
Let's sort things out as they stand now. First, distinguish for us the watch versus the warning. I have to stop and think that through still.
Yeah, so when a watch comes out, that means there's a potential for a dangerous hazard. And typically, this is something that, just to kind of distinguish between severe weather and a winter weather, the watch is typically something that we're going to put out a few days in advance, or maybe 2 days, so that you can kind of say, all right, you know, there's a potential that something's going to come through. And as anybody knows that's gone through winter here in Wisconsin, that can change in the matter of days leading up to when that snowstorm's going to happen. So the watch is really to kind of get your attention that potential is there, but things can change. The next step is the warning or advisory phase, where it's either an imminent or occurring hazard that's in place. So for the warning, that's a life-threatening hazard. That's something that's going to shut stuff down, winter storm warning level type stuff. It's going to be really bad that this is going to happen. The advisory level is more of a less serious hazard. So it's something that is, we've used it to get people's attention that there's going to be this snow. If you don't give yourself enough time to get to work or get to school, you might be a little bit late getting there, but it's probably not going to cause, you know, shutdown type of a situation. So that's where some of that confusion has come in, even between the watch and warning phase, because they begin with WA, people get that confused, even when it comes to severe weather.
And so for a tornado watch, I'm like, okay, maybe I don't go out for that walk then. For the tornado warning, I'm like, I'm going to walk down to the basement now.
Yeah, that's correct.
That about right?
So some people have actually, there's a TV meteorologist from North Carolina, Brad Panovich, who came up with this cupcake watch and a cupcake warning. Cupcake watch, the ingredients are there, but it's not put together. Cupcake warning, that cupcake's there, I'm going to eat that cupcake. So kind of the same thing with the tornado watch, tornado warning. That tornado's When it's a watch, the ingredients are there. The warning that storm is there, and it's either producing a tornado or something we're seeing on radar.
Now, I got to say, the one I think I mostly get watch versus warning. Advisory, and I know this is a big part of the review. I'm not sure what that means or when those come out. Can you talk a little more about the advisory?
Right. So the advisories would be something along the lines of winter weather advisories, wind advisories, heat advisories. These are all levels of advisories that they're meant to get your attention that, hey, if you don't prepare for this, you're going to be inconvenienced by this. Dense fog advisories. A lot of people will say, you know, when I go out, I see the dense fog. You know, obviously that fog is there. I'm being advised of it. Winter weather advisory. Part of this project actually changed a few years ago, where we used to have snow advisories, freezing rain advisories, and winter weather advisories, and those were all combined into the winter weather advisories. So that's part of what this survey is to find out, do you find that level of information, at least for this headline, important enough for your decision making? Does that grab your attention before you go to bed at night to help you prepare for the next day? Or are you paying enough attention to what the forecast is and how you personally are going to be impacted by a 3 to 5 inch snowfall or a 45 mile per hour wind if it's a wind advisory type day? So those are some of the things that the survey goes through. But for the advisory level, it's generally more of an inconvenience than something that's going to be a shutdown type of a situation.
Talking to Tim Halbach, Warning Coordination Meteorologist for the National Weather Service office in Milwaukee. Sullivan, talking about efforts by the Weather Service to maybe change the way they tell us about impending weather, and they're looking for your input on this. And let's get to that now, Tim. How can members of the public help the National Weather Service figure out the best language to use?
So right now there's a survey that's out. Actually, if you try to go to it right now at this moment, the SurveyMonkey, the website that we're using to do the survey, is actually down for maintenance, ironically, but it's supposed to be up by about 10 o'clock tonight. So if you go to weather.gov, that's gov/Milwaukee, or any of the other Weather Service offices in the nation probably have something up on their website where you can click on a link and go to this survey that you can go through. It doesn't take too long. It just asks you questions about what you think about this idea that we're coming up with to try to better change the scenario. So there have been times where, you know, we get this feedback that no, you shouldn't be doing this. You know, don't get rid of this advisory. That's come directly from these surveys. So if people don't take the survey and let us know what they think of it, the people at our headquarters won't have anything to go by to say, like, well, there's obviously a big concern here for this. There's actually been one level where people fought back pretty quickly, where the small craft advisories were part of this, and the feedback they got immediately from the marine users were like, absolutely not, you can't get rid of that. And the Weather Service like, okay, yeah, we get it. So this is kind of to dangle the fruit out there, or kind of see what people actually think of this. So there's been these preliminary talks and work that's been done. And now we're looking for people to help us out by taking the survey and let us know what they think.
And as I understand it, Tim, one option on the table here might be to take out the word advisory and just say the thing. Can you talk about what that might look like on our phones or wherever we go for our weather info?
Sure. So we are going to continue to forecast the same way. And something that we work a lot on is the messaging and trying to figure out how are people going to be impacted by the weather that we're looking at. We have the forecast models that we might see that, hey, there's going to be this inch of snowfall that's going to occur at rush hour. That's probably going to cause some impacts to what's going to be coming that day. Historically, we'd use something like a winter weather advisory to make people aware of that, to get that extra headline. But the proposal that's on the table would be that there'd be this kind of statement type product that the Weather Service would go to that kind of catches all this, where we can still put this out and it goes out in kind of a similar bolted fashion to what the advisory had been or other levels of that kind of a heads up statement. So in terms of the forecast itself and hearing, you know, this messaging, we have ways to get that out to the public from our website or from mobile.weather.gov to where you can get a specific forecast for your location. But we also put out information on our Facebook and Twitter pages to say, here's kind of the impacts that we're expecting from this, the weather that's coming up. So those would be the other spots that you would be able to get that. We also work closely with a lot of different decision makers, like school district administrators, when school is in session and there's winter storms, the highway folks that have to clear streets and all that. We send them emails that say, you know, here's what our expectations are. So we're still getting that information out to these decision makers. But for the public, it would be more so going to Facebook and Twitter and seeing what our messaging is for the weather that's coming their way.
And just our last minute, Tim, change the subject a little bit. Central Time producers are very curious. When will this long streak of fairly hot and humid weather last?
Fall.
<it's>,
no, this is, it looks like we're in a kind of a stuck pattern here where it's going to be this high levels of heat and humidity. Right now, it's actually just below what we consider for our heat advisory thresholds, which you would still see right now. We haven't cut them out or anything. But typically, when the heat index hits 100 degrees for a day, or if it's going to be like 4 days in a row where it's going to be 95 to 99 degrees, we would have a heat advisory. So it doesn't really look like much in the next week or two. Maybe towards mid-July, we're kind of seeing some trends for something potentially changing the pattern up a bit, but appears that we're stuck for a little bit here going into the peak of what we consider our summer here in Wisconsin.
Huh. All right, Tim, thanks a lot anyway.
No problem.
That's Tim Halbach, warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service office in Milwaukee Sullivan. He joins today mainly to talk about a plan from the National Weather Service looking at possible changes to its severe weather warning system to help be more clear. They are looking for public input on the potential changes. We've got a link to that, that survey at WPR.org. As we heard, it's down right now, but it should be up by later tonight. Coming up, the USMCA trade deal took effect this week. We'll find out what changes and what it means for Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, a proposed state law would boost pay and provide extra sick leave for healthcare workers during the COVID-19 pandemic. Kate Archer-Kent gets the details from one of the authors of that bill. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement officially took effect on Wednesday. President Trump signed the agreement earlier this year. It replaces NAFTA in setting the rules of trade in North America. The administration says the USMCA will help keep manufacturing jobs in the U.S. and provide stability for farmers who are dealing with tariffs during the ongoing trade dispute. But open questions remain on things like labor standards in Mexico and Canadian metal exports. Mark Koplovich is a professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. His research focuses on international trade and finance. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Always great to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Well, Mark, the USMCA kicked in 2 days ago and boom, everything changed. We flipped a switch, right? Or does it not work that way?
No, it doesn't really work that way. I mean, there's an enormous disconnect. There often is with trade agreements, but in this case, even larger than normal, I think, between the political marketing of this and the economic reality of it. You know, I would say from what I've seen and read and followed on this, that it's about 90% what was in NAFTA. And the 10% that's new, most of what's new was actually in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was the trade agreement that Trump actually withdrew from when he first came into office that the Obama administration had negotiated. So the political reality is this is being sold as a huge transformation of trade between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. And there are some changes, but the reality is it's actually going to have very little overall effect on the U.S. economy. And unlike most trade agreements, it's actually going to leave the overall U.S. economy a little worse off.
How so?
So it actually increases barriers to trade in many cases, right? So one of the big components of this is an increase in what's known as rules of origin, which is local North American content for steel in particular in auto production. And so what that's actually going to do is it's going to increase the cost of steel being produced in cars in North America. The reason behind that is that Trump and Bob Lighthizer and Peter Navarro, the key trade officials in the administration, are very keen on bringing manufacturing back to the United States and kind of breaking what are known as global value chains, right, where pieces of manufacturing are done across countries. But that's actually going to raise costs for consumers, right? So the projections that are out there is the rising prices on steel inputs, and some of the increases in wages in Mexico that are also part of the agreement are going to raise costs, and that's actually going to possibly reduce U.S. exports for cars. But what it's definitely going to do is raise prices for American consumers on automobiles.
But the trade-off there, the idea, at least the argument is, okay, but we've got better paying jobs in the metal industry, the steel and aluminum producing in particular. So yes, we might lose a little there, but we gain a lot for some maybe cities that rely on that kind of manufacturing.
It's not really clear that's going to happen, right? So that's the part of the underlying theory, I think, is that. But when you're putting up trade barriers, most American manufacturers are importers and consumers of things like steel and aluminum. And so if you're raising prices on key inputs of production for U.S. manufacturers, the net effects on employment in the steel and aluminum sectors, it's not clear actually there's going to be an increase, right? Because that means that American producers and American consumers are going to be reducing their consumption of higher priced steel and aluminum. So it gets complicated, right? And when you crunch the numbers on this and look at the overall effects, the estimates that I've seen suggest that there's going to be a very tiny, if any, negative effect on overall GDP, and that the employment impact is also going to be pretty minimal.
Talking to Mark Koplovich, professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison, about the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the replacement, the update to NAFTA that kicked into effect this week. Mark, looking at manufacturing here in Wisconsin, we're a pretty big manufacturing state. People think of companies like Harley Davidson, producers of farm equipment, farm machinery, things like that. Are they the kind of companies that might be hurt by those changes in metal supply chains?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's sort of two things. So one is that, which is, if you're a manufacturing firm and key inputs of production are rising in price, that raises your costs, right? And it makes it hard for you to be competitive in exporting goods around the world if you're facing rising costs. The other thing is this really doesn't open up new markets, right? So this is replacing NAFTA, which is the free trade agreement we've had with these same two countries since 1994. What we were originally going to have in 2017 was the Trans-Pacific Partnership that was going to do most of what's in this new USMCA with Canada and Mexico, but then also reduce trade and investment barriers with 9 other countries in the Pacific Rim. What manufacturers in Wisconsin and elsewhere are not getting is increased access to the Japanese market, the Australian market, the Vietnamese market. This doesn't really further reduce trade barriers and increase market access to Mexico and Canada for American producers. And it also robs them of the benefits of possibly accessing other export markets.
Well, let's look at agriculture and dairy in particular. One of the big complaints, including from Wisconsin dairy farmers, was that Canada had this system that prioritized some of their own dairy products. And I've talked to cheese producers who say historically Mexico had changed things that you couldn't use the name of a European cheese on a Wisconsin cheese. They had to make up new names. Does USMCA clarify any of that? Does it end up helping, say, that Wisconsin dairy farmer and or cheese producer?
A little bit. And it's not nothing. But again, it's kind of small. So the Canadian government definitely made some concessions on things like import quotas. They had a series of import quotas and other restrictions on American dairy into Canada. Mexico is Wisconsin agriculture's largest export market, dairy's largest export market, Canada's number 3. The numbers I've seen suggest that, the USMCA is going to increase access into the Canadian market. It's going to assure access of about 3.6%. The rules in the TPP, which this actually replaced, would have guaranteed access of about 3.2%. So that's $600 million. That's not nothing, right? But it's not, again, it's not a game changer and a sort of transformative large access that suddenly American dairy producers and Wisconsin producers in particular are going to have a 5, 10, 15, 20, a 20-point change in market share in Canadian consumption. So it's better than the status quo, but again, it's sort of modest. And again, it's sort of part of the bigger picture that if you put these small, modest gains in particular sectors, then the overall effect for growth and employment on the U.S. economy is slightly negative and certainly not transformative.
Mark Koplovich is with us, professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. We're talking about the USMCA, the trade agreement that replaces NAFTA. It officially took effect this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does this affect your livelihood in one way or another? Do you work in manufacturing, agriculture, or another sector that's being impacted by this new agreement? Do you have a question about the effects of the changes from NAFTA to this new thing? Are there things you still think need to be resolved in the way we trade with, especially our neighbors, Mexico and Canada, and maybe beyond? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Mark Koplovich, talking about what's changing and what isn't changing with the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal taking effect earlier this week, effectively replacing and updating NAFTA. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching what's changing here? Do you like the changes? Do you think more changes needed to be made? President Trump at some points had threatened to just pull out of NAFTA altogether. Would you have liked to have seen that? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Greg is with us in Sheboygan. Greg, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, is it possible if a new president comes in, could he go to the Congress and the Senate and just negate everything that Trump has done? I mean, we got to have that done. I mean, it's got to be done. I mean, seriously, the guy is not a very good businessman. He's filed bankruptcy 6 times. He's not making good deals. He's jumping out of every agreement we ever had and making enemies of all our allies. I mean, crying out loud.
Greg, thanks a lot for that call. First of all, is this a no-backsies arrangement, Mark? Can a new president just pull us out of this deal?
So, you know, this is something that had to be approved by Congress. And it's interesting. So Congress has ultimate control over international treaties, but also ultimate control over trade policy. But since the 1960s, they have delegated more and more of it to the president. Right. So we're 3 years into the Trump administration's trade war on various fronts with China, with our North American allies, with the European Union. The bills and rules under which Trump is making all of these decisions are things that Congress could actually change at any time. But there hasn't been a coalition really to do that. I think the main reason is that, you know, both on the right and the left of the political spectrum, for different reasons, there are opponents to free trade. Right. And there are, as we've talked a lot in past times I've been on here, trade is good in the aggregate for growth and for wealth and welfare in a country like the United States. But there are enormous distributional consequences. Right. There are some sectors and individuals that win and some sectors that lose. And so when you think about politicians trying to get reelected, that, you know, you get a lot of politicians on both sides of the political spectrum that don't want to step on trade as a controversial topic and are happy to kind of punt it to the president. And historically, we've thought that was good because the president would think about the country more as a whole and what's good for the country as a whole and would focus more on free trade than, you know, an individual representative in a specific geographic district that might want to protect a certain industry and whatnot. So Congress could step in. I think what we would definitely see if there was a change in administration come January is walking back a lot of the threats to, say, withdraw from the World Trade Organization, an end to the use of these national security tariffs, right? So the steel and aluminum tariffs with Canada, Mexico, Korea, et cetera, the justification for them is from a 1962 law where the president can impose steel tariffs when there's a surge in imports and there's a threat to national security. Right? And there's been no surge in imports. There's a kind of long-term decline in the U.S. steel and aluminum industry because of global competition. And it's very clear that the national security argument, when we're talking about our closest NATO allies like Canada, doesn't really hold. So I think you would see a Biden administration certainly re-embracing and engaging with the World Trade Organization and engaging in removing the kind of aggressive protectionism. I don't know if you'll see a renegotiation of the USMCA. I could imagine you could see a Biden administration saying we're going to re-enter the TPP, and then that would effectively replace the USMCA because Canada and Mexico already belong to that, and we don't.
Greg, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about international trade, and the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement just came into effect this week, effectively replacing NAFTA. Mark Koplovich with us from UW-Madison. Mark, that distributional element of this, we've talked about in the past, the idea that overall free trade might help us out to improve prices and things like that, but some people get hurt, and that damage is often really devastating to a local community if they lose that industrial base. What do you do to mediate that, to limit the damage, to help people who are hit by the downside of this?
Yeah, the trade agreements get a lot of blame, but really a lot of these trends are long-term trends in the structural change in the U.S. economy over the last 50 years. And so tariffs don't really, they can slow that down a little bit, but they're not going to stop those big trends. The thing we haven't had in the U.S. is, domestic policies, social welfare policies, investment policies, infrastructure policies, subsidization of education and retraining. There's a lot of set of policies that governments, at the state level, at the federal level, could put in place to try and offset the negative consequences, right? The simplest but most politically sensitive one would actually be to directly, pay people who have lost their jobs from the increases in aggregate wealth in the United States, right? So trade over the last 60 years has actually raised household wealth by about a third across the country on average. But we don't redistribute that wealth from the winners and losers to the losers and the economic losers in American society because it's politically controversial. But there's a lot of domestic policies we could put in place. It's pretty clear, the U.S. trade deficit has widened under the Trump administration, and you haven't really stopped any of these trends, that tariffs are kind of, they're politically maybe salient, but they're a stopgap for changing these long-term transformative shape of the U.S. economy. And most of the policies that might make a big difference, we haven't really tried over the last 40 years.
Just in our last minute, Mark, what is still up in the air when it comes to trade issues between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada? This agreement doesn't solve anything in just our last few moments, or solve everything.
No. So, the Trump administration is talking about reinstituting another round of the steel aluminum tariffs. And I think the bigger picture with Canada and Mexico is the Trump administration is also threatening to withdraw from the World Trade Organization and has basically brought to a complete stop the court system in the WTO, where countries resolve disputes. And Canada and Mexico, along with Japan and the European Union and Australia and other major countries, are kind of moving on trying to find alternatives. So I think it's part of the bigger picture with Canada and Mexico that the U.S. isn't really leading in setting the rules of the game of global trade anymore. And it's not clear that we're still seen as a reliable partner, right? So I think the USMCA, because the Trump administration is still talking about more types of tariffs and protection, is still not seen as something that has settled the dispute and settled the problems between these three countries.
Mark, thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Mark Koplovich is a professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. You can keep the conversation going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can pick up this conversation about what changes and what doesn't change as the NAFTA replacement, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, takes effect. The tourism season is ramping up on Washington Island, an isolated community off the mainland from Door County. As Rob Mentzer reports, the island's experience is a window into how Wisconsin's tourism industry is adapting to COVID-19 with a mix of optimism and anxiety.
The 10 a.m. ferry to Washington Island is full. It's the only way onto the island, about 7 miles off the coast of Door County. In the early days of the COVID-19 crisis, there were just 2 ferries a day, and they mostly carried packages and freight, not people.
We had to go back to like 1950s or 60s to get kind of ridership numbers that low.
Hoyt Purinton is president of the Washington Island Ferry Line. He says ridership has picked up, but it's not back to what he'd call normal.
Typically this time of year, in the past 3 or 4 years, we would be running, we'd have 21 or 22 trips scheduled today. We have 11 or 12.
Tourism accounts for something like 80% of Washington Island's economy, which means the island needs visitors. And like a lot of places in Wisconsin, people here are trying to figure out what a safe tourism season looks like in the age of coronavirus.
Early in the crisis, there was a lot of don't come here kind of stuff. Keep your virus downstate. Don't come here. We're vulnerable.
Bob Atwell is CEO of Nicolet Bank. He lives in Sturgeon Bay and spends weekends on Washington Island. He says there's a tension between people whose jobs depend on tourism and those who'd rather not see visitors this year.
It might work for people who came up here, retired, and had their money when they got here, but how does it work for people who need to make a living while they're here?
Of course, it's not just retirees who worry that hosting thousands of out-of-town visitors just isn't safe. Tate Remke is a bank teller and a barista at Red Cup Coffee House.
I have 2 elderly parents. I have a lot of elderly friends. I worry for the community and all the people that I love here.
Lots of tourist towns rely on summer business, but Washington Island's peak season is really just 2 months long.
The money is made in July and August on Washington Island.
Richard Toby is town chairman. He says business is starting to bounce back. One example, he and his wife rent out a historic family house to vacationers.
We opened that up on Monday last week, and by Thursday we were booked through the second week of September solid. I mean, just gone. So as far as people wanting to come to Washington Island, it sure looks like there's plenty of folks available.
It helps that a lot of what people want to do on vacation in Wisconsin are outdoor activities that health officials say are relatively safe. You can hike or kayak. You can ride around the island on a moped. Edgar Anderson, who owns a lavender farm on the island, puts it this way.
If there is a place to social distance, you're looking at it.
Wisconsin tourism has another advantage. Most people who visit here come by car. Tourism officials say families who've canceled air travel this year are likely taking local vacations instead. Sarah Gibson is an owner of Jackson Harbor Soup and Sandwiches. The restaurant looks out on Lake Michigan and northwest to Rock Island, a state park that's still closed.
I would say we are maybe getting closer to 50% of where we were at last year.
Gibson says she thinks the restaurant can survive on mostly takeout and patio dining this summer.
Yeah, you hear 50%, oh, that's not a lot. But the thing is, it's something, and we're here to maintain what we can.
She says she hopes the weather will cooperate. She hopes the spread of the disease won't require them to close again. And she hopes the tourists who visit the island town where she grew up will be considerate of others' health. Her business won't make what it made last year, but it just might be enough. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Find more reporting on what's going on around Wisconsin over at WPR.org/news. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, Fox Valley communities are starting to open up community conversations about race and racism. We'll find out how they're trying to have productive conversations about a difficult issue. A new survey aims to track a humble bird here in Wisconsin. You can find out how the chimney swift is doing here in the state. And historian Ken Davis is back with us, author of the Don't Know Much About History series of books. This time he'll mark the weekend's holiday with a history of Independence Day and how we've celebrated it over the decades. And you can let us know how you are celebrating this weekend, maybe a little different than the normal July 4th holiday for you. Send us a note now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or tell us your plans on Twitter. We are at Central Time WPR. All that and look at some of the top news of the day. It's coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 7, Wisconsin elections are the subject of lawsuits in state and federal courts. WPR Capitol reporter Laurel White brings us the latest and what it all means for the way we vote in November. That's Monday at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's a great weekend for putting some ribs on the grill. We'll talk with a barbecue expert about how to make sure we end up with something delicious. You can share your rib cooking secrets right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.